The April 21st, 2005 meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. We're continuing on House Bill 5038. It's a public hearing, and this relates to the Department of Human Services budget for the children, adults, and families. And we're on a phase two presentation, and we will continue with Assistant Director Ramona Foley and others. I need to say that there are some of the members of the committee that went to a hearing last night in Tillamook and will not be back today. But those of us that are here are all ears.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And I believe what we are picking up this morning is on page 18 with the enhanced overpayment collections package. And Mr. Neely is going to discuss that package with us.
Is that under after the red tab?
Yes. I'm sorry. Here? After the red tab.
Good morning, Mr. Neely.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Package 119, Enhanced Overpayment Collection Staff. A question actually came up yesterday about how we arrived at the net collections here. And let me briefly tell you what I found in terms of this calculation, and we'll get this in writing to you with the remainder of the questions that you asked yesterday, and we hope to do that very shortly. Each overpayment rider writes approximately $50,000 of overpayments every month over the course of the year. It's higher in tax season, less so other times of the year, but average is about $50,000 a month. The overpayments that are written result in approximately $25,000 worth of collections every month. 70% of the overpayments relate to the TANF program, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. The state retains 100% of these collections. 30% of the overpayments relate to food stamps, and 80% of those recoveries go back to the federal government. So from this package, we anticipate about 4.8 million total recoveries. About 1.16 of that goes back to the feds. That leaves net recoveries of 3.64 million.
Okay, I have a question. Just would you mind explaining to us what the history has been in recent years on the $50,000 a month of overpayments and what's being done? I mean, as far as was it 100,000 3 years ago and now we've cut that in half, or has it been steady at 50,000? And if so, why would it be? Why are we accepting $50,000 a month of overpayments as acceptable?
Mr. Chair, let me have somebody here.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would like to say how many folks are doing this, because it might not just be $50,000 a month. It was $50,000 per person.
Okay.
Collecting. So
thank you. That's
so
that's
we might want to get it's going to be more than 50,000 a month.
What is the total? What has the total been, and what is being done to lessen that amount? I mean, we're talking now about solving it, about trying to recollect. And well, we are. He just said 25,000 per month out of 50,000 worth of charges. So just let's first look at the problem before we focus again on the solution, okay?
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I understand correctly, you want some discussion on how we're trying to reduce what's owed to us as opposed to how we're trying to collect it?
Help me understand, is the $50,000 in overpayment per month per that is assigned to each of the collection individuals? Maybe define what that $50,000 is that you first mentioned.
Mr. Chair, as we identify potential overpayments, we send those to overpayment writers who research what's been paid versus what should have been paid to an individual in a grant per month.
Okay.
Say they forgot to tell us about their earnings or something like that. So their grant should have been less, so we overpaid them. The overpayment writers write up that overpayment. And on average, they're writing up about $50,000 worth of overpayments per month.
Per person.
Per person. Per each overpayment writer.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, so how many overpayment writers are there?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Cindy Becker, Deputy Director of the Department. We have about 26 overpayment riders. We do overpayments. I think you heard it earlier when we talked about department-wide support services. We do overpayments for our client overpayments and also provider. This particular section that Mr. Neely is talking about are the pursuit of overpayment collections against clients.
Right.
And the average has been about $50,000 per person per month.
Okay, and we have $1.3 million of monthly overpayments, right?
Correct. And but, for example, as Jim said, the last month in March, we had about $150,000 per person because it's tax time and we just get more money around tax time.
When you say we get more money, does that mean the recovery?
Recovery is higher.
Although, was there more overpayments made as well, or was the additional money from past?
The additional money is from past because people have the ability to actually pay the money.
Okay. All I'm asking is what, you know, I don't know if we're looking at an average, and I don't know if it is or not, of $1.3 million per month, then, you know, that's what, you know, $18-20 million a year. Is that good or is that bad compared to other states? Is the amount of our overpayments diminishing or increasing? Where are we as far as the problem of overpayments before we talk further about the solution, Nate?
Well, Mr. Chair, as you saw, I think, from the information, the audit that Sheila handed out yesterday when she began, the Secretary of State's audit on TANF and eligibility payment accuracy there showed, I believe, less than a 1% error rate, which for most payment programs would be considered extraordinary. We'll talk a bit about this as we get into the food stamp program later. We've reduced our error rate in the food stamp program by over 40%. In the last year, so we now believe we are just at the cusp of not having an issue with the federal government over our air rate and food stamp. So we are, I would say, dramatically improving our air rates and reducing that amount out there that we need to collect.
Could you take just a minute and say what have you done that has resulted in the 40% reduction? I mean, that's substantial.
Well, Mr. Chair, specifically in the food stamp program, we've put rather a lot of effort into that. In the past, when we have exceeded the federal error tolerance, their requirement to us was that we reinvest a portion of that and to try and improve our administrative process. More recently, they've decided, well, they'd rather have a check from us rather than helping us improve our process. So, faced with that, we actually developed a review process in which we try to get actually down to the worker level in terms of our notion of how accurate the workers are. The federal quality control review process, while it is significant at a statewide level, even at a regional level, won't tell you if you're really doing well or poorly. So we have required supervisors and reviewers to do enough reviews so that we know down to the worker level which workers are having difficulties. And then we help them either with training or, on the other hand, if after training and whatever help we can give them, they're still having trouble, we look for other things that they might do other than be food stamp certifiers. So it's about paying attention to it.
Okay. Also, Mr. Chair, according to our guru, our collection rate is the highest in the Northwest, in the Northwest states. So we do a very good job on collections. But as Jim said, our real goal is to get the payment right to begin with and not have the over-collection.
Right, and that's what we're talking about.
Right, right.
Senator Bates.
Just a quick aside on the food stamp program, which we're probably going to talk about later anyway, but the history of this program is interesting, and that's where the error rate came in. And we are under a mandate by the federal government to vastly increase that program after some studies indicated that this was the hungriest state in the union and we were not fully utilizing the food stamp program. So we had this massive ramp-up of it and putting in a bunch of new workers who had never done it before. And when someone does something for the first time, obviously They don't know what they're doing to start with. They're doing the best they can. You probably have a few people that you can't quite get there no matter what happens. And this is the next thing that happened after ramping the program up and the federal government saying, nice job. They said, oh, by the way, you didn't do it right. Now we want to penalize you for ramping up. And then we had to deal with that problem. I think what's happened is they've got the program fully ramped now, probably shaken out those who can't quite get the job done, and they've got the other ones trained properly, so now we're in good shape. But it was really a result of not utilizing the program properly for years, suddenly ramping it up and then leveling it off. And it's like taking a plane up fast and pursues a pretty rough air, and then once you get up to 40,000 feet, it's smooth sailing. I think that's where you're at. That's probably what you went through, and I think having that background is helpful, because I know some committee members haven't watched that program in the last 4 or 5 years. I think it's okay. Mr. Neely, would you agree that's what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'd say that's a pretty fair assessment overall.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that very well might be a great assessment, and I'd want to sit here next time, I guess, and say it's still hard to look at that, you know, $16 million or roughly is made in overpayment, and $8 million of that is uncollected. I mean, that's still $8 million that somebody could be using that we're missing. So I guess what I'm hoping, if what Senator Bates says is true, that, you know, in a biennium from now, we do sit down and say, we went through the rough period, it is smoother air, and now it's not 50% or more and uncollected. I mean, I still think we have a responsibility to do the best job we can of collecting that money.
Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, make myself clear. I was talking about the food stamp program being ramped up suddenly, not about what you're talking about right now. This is an ongoing problem, and you're okay. Absolutely correct. Overpayments to providers, while they're very small numbers, when you multiply that over the large amount of the program, that's where you come up with those figures, and I agree with what you're saying.
It might be a very small percentage,
but it adds up to big money.
A lot of numbers.
And I agree with
you.
And so I don't misinterpret me here. I was talking purely about the food stamp program, the ramp-up, not what you're talking about, which is an ongoing problem, which I share with you.
Okay. Now, we're talking about TANF and food stamps, right?
I mean, the medical assistance.
The $1.3 million a year, the $50,000, the $25,000, is this TANF and food stamp payments and collections?
Food stamps only, right?
Yes. Okay. All right. Okay, so we're all on the same page.
It's a mixture, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so, and if Senator Bates is correct on his assessment, then that means that when we come back in 2 years, it won't be as high, the overpayments won't be as high, because you will have corrected that problem, and hopefully we'll have better recovery, although that may or may not be related. I mean, first is paying too much, and then it's how do you get it back from people that don't have a lot of resources anyway, or they wouldn't be receiving these payments. And I can see that's sometimes difficult to get money back.
Mr. Chair, I would add that, yes, I absolutely believe that the rate with which overpayments are occurring will be reduced when we're sitting here, or whoever's sitting here 2 years from now.
That's always an issue.
One of the issues is, I mean, we have issues making overpayments on our side of the table, as well as we have issues with clients sometimes who either forget to or purposely don't tell us about things that will impact on their grant. And while there are things that we can do to improve their reporting, that will always be a part of the mix that we can't control 100%.
Is there also an issue with underpayment?
Mr. Chair, there is an issue of underpayments, and as we discover those, typically, if we discover them within a two-year period, and ordinarily we discover them sooner than that, we rectify those as well. So we have underpaid clients as well as overpaid them.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue. Thanks for the clarification.
We're still on this.
Well, I think that's a great segue to package 129, the federally mandated quality control process. What we have been doing in probably the past 14 years or so is looking at the Oregon Health Plan in an agreed upon way with CMS, the Center for Medicaid, Medicare, services, and we have not been doing what we did in the past in terms of a traditional Medicaid quality control review.
Mr. Neely, before we get into that, I'm still, my brain's still working on 119, okay. And I have a question about the cost that DHS is incurring to bring about the recovery of the 50% of the overpayment. Because, of course, what I'd like to know is it more expensive for DHS to be doing a collection agency work than it would be if we had an outside collection agency that only does that? And so can you give me an idea, or just let us know what kind of overhead we're incurring to do this collection work?
First let me talk about the cost of these additional positions. We were at net recoveries available to offset general fund expenditures after what we've paid back to the federal governments, and in terms of what we actually recover, $3.64 million.
Excuse me, was that $3.64 million a net recovery after reimbursement to the federal government?
That's correct.
Or the overhead that's incurred with 26 employees?
No, Mr. Chair, this is for the package only, not for the 26 okay. employees that we have currently. This is for the 13 positions that this package would fund.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the salary of these individuals is about $2,200 a month.
Okay.
So that you can compare that to the collections as well.
And that for this package, it's a total fund cost of about $1.6
million. Okay. All right. Thank you.
So we take that away from the 3.6 okay. net recoveries to get to the...
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Phase two is more fun than phase one, by the way.
We love it, too.
One question creates another. I guess, again, this is rough math, but if you say you collected 50% of it at just under $8 million and the net savings is 2.9, did it cost you 4.9 to collect 2.9? See my point there? You have $7.8 million that's uncollected, and so that's what you collected out of that as well, because you had a 50% collection rate. So you collected $7.8 million, but you netted $2.9 million. So the difference is the cost.
In terms of what we collect, if you're going to add the cost of what we can't collect into this, okay.
No, I'm saying you only collected 50%, which is 7.8 million of the 15.6, using your numbers, saying, 1.3 million a month. That's 15.6 annually. You collect half of that. That's 7.8. Your paper shows a 2.9 million net recovery. So
it's costing us in general funds $742,000 for these 13 positions to collect $3.6 million in general fund.
Okay, I think you're using total funds, right?
Yeah, I am.
It's all tax money, so we're not just looking at general fund.
Yeah, I'm just saying you're collecting 7.8, you're netting 2.9, so somewhere 4.9 goes away to get there.
I'm sorry, the 7.8 was from?
Half $15.6 million. Where'd you get we've got to go back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Panda, I think what we're doing here is we're mixing the package in these overpayments and recoveries with our total overpayments and recoveries.
Right.
Which is 26 employees plus the package, additional employees. I've asked Sheila Baker to obtain from you a full overview or detail, actually a detail of the collection department, including the 26 people, the total amounts of money, and the package, so that we can get a sense of what all the money is and how it breaks down and how much the net is and the efficiency involved. Okay, so I mean we don't have to bore down into that in this group.
Right. We have that information. Okay. Not a problem.
So is that all right with you? If we get that,
sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So we can go on. Any other questions on 119? With the understanding that we're going to give a detail of the whole department.
Okay.
We go on to 129.
Okay, still on page 18, package 129, federally mandated quality control process. With the improper payment act, we are now required by the feds to do an entirely different Medicaid control process and increasing our sample size by about 300%. And they've required us to discontinue the review that we have been doing of the Oregon Health Plan standard population and switch over to the categorical populations, those Medicaid programs that are typically attached with other programs. So we have estimated that based on what we had seen originally in the regulations, that would take a total of seven FTE to do the quality control process that the feds require from us. And typical of federal requirements in quality control, they don't ask the states to figure out how to make sure we're doing the right thing. They tell us down to the forms what forms we're going to use, what our sample size has to be, how we collect the information, and how we report it. At this point, I think what we have in the package here is probably conservative based on what we've seen in additional draft regulations from CMS. But at this point, we're estimating 7 FTE for that.
Questions, anyone?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
You recently changed your policy on looking at lessons I recently bought 2 years ago and made, I think, a significant improvement as far as looking at providers in the situation. We used to get a lot of complaints that, especially from physicians, that they were essentially seeing on a fee-for-service basis Medicaid patients at a net loss and then had to put up with an audit. And you've changed that. I was also still concerned that you mentioned the Medicaid program. Is this part? Are you auditing part of the program outside of CAF as far as OHP is concerned and fee for service in this package?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, as I understand it, this issue is strictly around eligibility for clients as opposed to providers and those audits, which are handled by a different section.
Thank you. We'll deal with that. I would think we'd be under different departments, so I was surprised. So this is just strictly eligibility requirements, is all. Okay, thanks. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then moving over to page 19, ending balances. The law enforcement medical liability account, or LEMLA as we call it, is the only ending balance we anticipate in children, adults, and families. As of the end of February, the balance of the LEMLA program was just over $1 million. And to refresh, the law enforcement medical liability account is to cover folks who have been injured while they're being taken into custody. And in fact, you have on page 3 of the packet that we gave you yesterday a little more information about the LEMLA account. Okay, if there are no other questions about that, we'll flip past the... Hopefully you have a blue divider shortly after page 19.
Which one that's yesterday? Packet. Yes?
Have I lost everybody?
The one we received yesterday that has more, is it this one?
Yes.
That one.
Yes. For the priority list. Okay. Thank you.
It's April 19th.
I got it.
And in fact, almost all of the programs that we'll be talking about today in more detail will have some additional detail in that folder. And there's a table of contents, I think, right after the cover page.
I want to thank you for this detailed information. I mean, a lot of work went into this, and it's very useful for us. And besides that, sometimes it's hard to go to sleep at night, and this really makes such a difference.
Oh, seriously. I fear we're doomed by faint praise.
Thank you for that compliment.
Oh, it is. It's very good.
If that's how you meant it.
It was. It is a compliment. No, it is good. And it's helpful for us, especially the ones of us that really don't have a lot of experience, because we're trying to make up for the lack of experience by study.
Okay. Flipping past the blue page then to temporary assistance to needy families on a new page one. And what I'm going to try and do here, because job opportunities and basic skills and the TANF program are joined at the hip, I'm going to try and actually cover both of these issues at once here. I think it'll probably be less confusing if I do that. But starting with on page one there, in terms of the budget drivers for the TANF program, the state of the economy in general plays a role for us in TANF. In good economic times, it's I fear I've lost people again.
With you now.
Okay.
Thank you.
In good economic times, we have temporary assistance to needy families, clients who come to us, and they will have what we would consider multiple barriers to employment, and they'll test the labor market, and they'll find a job. In poor economic times, it's much more difficult for those folks to find jobs. So what we've seen in the past few years with a rougher economy, more difficulty for folks in the TANF program finding jobs through the jobs program. Now, what we're going to be talking about a bit more, probably in the near future, we no longer have a waiver in the TANF and jobs program. That waiver expired in June of 2003. Because TANF was not reauthorized, HHS, basically through the work of our two senators, sent us a letter saying, well, we won't penalize you if you keep operating the same program you've been doing in the meantime until TANF is reauthorized. So we have continued with the Oregon version of welfare reform, which I'll talk a bit about when we get to the history. But TANF, I believe, is about to be reauthorized. And the direction that Congress is going in that reauthorization is to be much more specific to states about what will count as far as participation in the jobs program. And they will have certain activities that will count and certain activities that won't count. Among those that probably we will not be able to count or will be able to count less are some of those support service activities and remedial activities that a lot of our clients need in order to get to work, especially in rougher economic times. Mental health services, drug and alcohol services, while those are fully accountable for us now under the program we're operating, I anticipate that as TANF is reauthorized, they'll say, well, okay, you can do that for 3 months, and after that, if you still do it, it's on you. It won't count as participation. And we will have very high participation requirements from them. So I think the program will look different when it's reauthorized. Congress thus far has pretty much steadfastly avoided the notion that waivers in the new program are a good thing, and they are not inclined to let states continue their waivers. Now, that was very important to us because in Oregon, the state legislature literally beat Congress to the punch with welfare reform, in that in 1995, the Oregon legislature passed Oregon welfare reform. Between 95 and 96, we worked with the federal governments under what was then the Aid to Dependent Children program to put those waivers into effect. As welfare reform was passed by federal Congress in 1996, there was a portion of that bill that said, if you're operating under a waiver, then you can continue operating under that waiver, irrespective of what federal welfare reform says, until that waiver expires. Well, we had just negotiated a 7-year waiver. So that's the waiver that expired in June of 2003. Our waiver really was among the first in the country that was designed to make work participation the rule rather than the exception, so that we tried to get almost all of our clients into the jobs program to move them on to employment. Because as we talk about cost savings, that really is the issue in the TANF program that is the major cost driver. If we can get a family employed, they won't be on TANF. And so that has a major...
Well, it solves a whole myriad of problems. They won't be on a lot of other areas, too, because a good job helps take away a lot of stress in families and, I mean, helps in many ways.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Chair, and there are many side benefits as well as the cost containment issue. In fact, we estimate that if program levels had stayed where they were in 1994 in terms of the TANF caseload, it would cost us about $242 million additional to finance that in the current biennium, 03-05. The caseload went from a high of about 44,000 families in 1994 to just around 20,000 families today. So in addition to the benefits of getting folks to work, it's had a major impact on the cost of the TANF program.
Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little concerned about what you might see coming from the federal government. I mean, basically, my relationship with the federal government, these kind of programs, is no good deed goes unpunished. And I'm fearful of what's going to happen here. Do you have any idea what the federal government's position is going to be on TANF in the future? I mean, Oregon's been a state that has led the nation in reducing people, dependence on welfare, got them to work. People get up in the morning and go to work. They actually pay taxes. Thank you. And state that's important. So you've really stopped a downward spiral. I don't know if you've put that into the $242 million in savings, the taxes brought in by those people working also. But having said that, what do you think the federal government's going to do on this? Do you have any perception of it at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, what we can provide for you is we have a recent side-by-side comparison of what the Senate and the House have proposed. They're similar, not that close together yet, but I think it'll give you a very good idea of where we're headed, and it indeed is, I believe, is headed in some of the ways that I share your concerns in terms of what will be accountable activity and what's actually the best thing for us to do for clients. If we have clients who need remedial services to become employed, to require them to do 35 hours of work site training is just not realistic, and while it probably will have an impact on the caseload, it won't be because these people have gone to work. It'll be because they were unable to participate the way they're required to, and so ultimately their case will be sanctioned. So, and Senator, I think you've actually hit it right on the head. I believe that what has happened in Oregon and ultimately what happened nationally with welfare reform was one of the social policy coups of the last century, in that there were dire predictions that when welfare was reformed that there will be thousands of people starving in the street. Some of Clinton appointees resigned over it. In fact, what we saw was dramatic decreases in caseload, dramatic increases in folks going to work, and none of the dire circumstances that were forecast by a few folks. So the notion that this has been a tremendous policy only to be followed by a notion that, well, in that case, we have to change it, I remain perplexed by that. But that indeed seems to be where Congress is going. Less latitude for the states.
Thank you.
One of the major differences I want to talk about when federal welfare reform happened was that what used to be a matching grant program in the days of the Aid to Dependent Children program, the federal government paid about 60% of the benefits and the state paid about 40%. When it became TANF in 1996, it was block granted, and the states were required to maintain a maintenance of effort, so that basically 75% of what we were paying in 1995 in terms of the state share was now the lower threshold. So we were required to maintain that. Through the years, as we've gone through the budgeting process, we and Department of Administrative Services have looked far and wide at other agencies that who are doing things that could be considered allowable under TANF, and to the extent that they're spending state general fund dollars on that, or state dollars on that, those would count in the maintenance of effort requirement. So every time we look at the possibility of reduction in TANF, we have to bear in mind where are we with our maintenance of effort expenditure level. Because as we dip below, if we dip below our maintenance of effort expenditures, the penalties pile on incrementally. That not only does our next TANF block grant get reduced by that, by the difference between what we should have put in and what we didn't, and we're at about $167 million a year in TANF block grant. So that block grant would get reduced by the difference that we didn't make our MOE, plus we're required to then replace that MOE that we didn't make with state general funds. And if we fail to do that, the penalty ramps up, and then in addition to that becomes a 5% penalty on top of that. So it's something that we're very concerned about as we look at the budget for the TANF program, watching that maintenance of effort level. I'd go to page 3, specific actions to contain cost. We've talked about continuing to get folks to work in the first year of this biennium. We got over 11,000 families back to work. We didn't do it ourselves. They participated in that. If you look towards the bottom of the page, in the governor's recommended budget, there's included a change in eligibility, which we talked a little bit about yesterday, which would establish an income level for no-parent households at 150% of the federal poverty level. So for families in which aunt, uncle, grandmother is taking care of the kids rather than their mother or father, where because they're not included in the grant, in the past we didn't look at their income. This would propose that we would look at their income, and at 150% of poverty, which for a household of three is about $1,960, they would not be eligible. They would be on their own to take care of those kids. Now, that has some crossover effect in terms of a number of those kids would very likely become foster care kids. So in addition to savings by doing this, there's also a cost as well. So what's in the governor's budget is a net savings after those costs. I would then move to page 7 to talk specifically about the governor's recommended budget proposals in the jobs piece of this, which includes three changes. First change, elimination of job support services payments to at-risk families. So as families come to us today and they look like they would be eligible for TANF, but typically they're employed, but there's something going on in their life. They're about to be evicted, or their car has broken down, or something is about to endanger their job. If it looks like otherwise they'd be TANF eligible, we can make a support service payment to take care of that so they don't come on to TANF.
I have a question on your comment that if the governor's recommended means testing for non-parent, which you kind of indicated is relative caring for the children, that some of them, whatever that number is, would go into foster care, is under the foster care program that we have in place provisions made for relative foster parents to receive payments if they qualify?
Chair Richardson, under our own statutes here in Oregon, the relative can only qualify if the child is what we call 4E eligible. In other words, if the child qualifies for federal financial assistance because the child would have been eligible under the old AFDC program, then that relative may receive for that child.
Is that over age 6 and special needs?
No, that's just any child who comes into foster care who qualifies for 4E eligibility. The state can't deny that child that access to 4E. But through a court case a number of years ago, Oregon was able to set about public policy that for the relative who's caring for a child and the child is not 4E eligible, then the state state does not offer a foster care board payment to that relative. That relative can apply for TANF and receive a child-only grant, but ordinarily, and some of those relatives do, but they would not qualify as they do in other states for a foster care board payment.
And is a 4E qualification a means-based?
The 4E qualification is a means-based and actually is a look back to an AFDC standard from 1997, 96 or 97. It's one of the things that did not get changed with the reauthorization and with welfare reform, so that states, a percentage of their children over time, you have fewer and fewer percentage of your children who are eligible for 4E because of the means test back to that point. It also relates to deprivation. There has to be deprivation. In other words, the child's parents aren't available to provide for the child, both in terms of caring for the child and financially, they're not able to care for the child. And those cases are also, as children come into foster care, those cases are also referred to child support enforcement.
Okay, thank you.
The second recommendation in the governor's budget relates to an overall 2.5% reduction in the jobs program. And the final recommendation at the governor's recommended budget involves $2.9 million in unexpended individual education accounts. And these accounts are accounts that are earned by individuals under the Jobs Plus program, which is a specific component of the Jobs program, which is a worksite program in which these folks are actually hired by typically a private sector employer. And while they're working, the employer contributes basically a dollar an hour into this individual and education account for them, which they are able to access once they leave the Jobs Plus program and go on to unsubsidized employment. What we've found over time is that a lot of folks are not accessing these accounts, and built into the law originally was a provision that if they didn't access them in 5 years, that those would revert to the Student Assistance Commission's Oregon Need Grant or Oregon Opportunity Grant. And so what we're proposing here and at the governor's recommended budget level is that rather than that accruing to the need grant, that it be used to offset budget costs.
Before you leave Jobs Plus, it's job opportunity and basic skills. As I go through all this, it really appears to me that, you know, we provide multiple areas of benefits to solve specific needs, but that the number two areas, the above everything else, is need for a good job for family and the need for basic life skills. Because as I see people there, some just can't get jobs because they don't, I mean, their lives are so messed up, or there's a reason why they're poor, and it's not just because of economic situation, other than, you know, they don't know how to do things that other people, because of history, do know. Does basic skills include helping people appear better, be able to interview, have hygiene, you know, things like that that would help them be more employable?
Mr. Chair, yes, indeed it does. Perhaps not to the extent that it did 10 years ago, as the job market was a bit more plentiful and we were, I won't say embarking on this process, but had been in it for some time and found indeed that one of the biggest issues that we had with our clients who really had not had much exposure to the labor market before was even a basic understanding that it really is important to get up in the morning and go to work, as opposed to, well, maybe not getting up or maybe going in late. And it really is a lot of those basic skills that they lacked. And over the years, we have, I think, put a fairly substantial amount of jobs program into those basic skills and continue to do that, especially in terms of those areas where it comes to presentation to an employer and how important it is to have not only child care but a backup child care plan or a backup transportation plan, or it's important how you dress, those kinds of things. It's still part of what we provide to folks who need that. Not everybody needs that. Mm-hmm. It is still available.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, moving on to emergency assistance on page 7. Economic conditions which contribute to family stress level, I believe, it contributes to an increased demand for our services related to a temporary assistance for domestic violence, as well as issues around increased alcohol and drug use. And just by way of a bit of history, the emergency assistance program was originally part of the Aid of Dependent Children program. In 1997, emergency assistance had covered typically financial emergencies related to shelter. Shelter and utilities were the biggest issues. That program was bifurcated in 1997 so that we had the regular emergency assistance programs, which had done the traditional work, and one specifically for domestic violence issues, as that was an increasing issue. And the other reason to bifurcate it was that while the dollars available to the program were constrained, the regular emergency assistance program cap in terms of expenditures was reduced so that for families who had domestic violence issues, which typically included the need to move or change housings, couldn't be covered under typical emergency assistance because there wasn't enough money there. So we bifurcated the program with the legislative assistance and had then a $1,200 cap for individuals who were seeking emergency assistance because of domestic violence issues, which has been, I think, extraordinarily helpful for those folks in taking themselves out of harm's way and getting relocated. Over the last few years, the regular emergency assistance program has continued to be reduced, ultimately to be closed, while the domestic violence portion of that continues on. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a 15% reduction proposed in the emergency assistance for domestic violence. That is the other area, including the LEMLA issue and the individual education accounts, that will take legislation to move that. The legislation currently says that program is frozen at its 1997 level in terms of payments and eligibility. And so to reduce that program will also take legislative action. Moving on to employment-related daycare, budget drivers in this relate to a couple of factors, some of which is a client choice issue. We pay different types of providers different rates for center child care center providers. We'll pay one rate for informal providers. We pay another rate. A couple of biennia ago, we were able, with legislative help, to set a higher rate for providers of all types who met minimum education levels. So there's a 7% differential there for providers who meet specified training requirements. As what we found, as unemployment rises, we have fewer people using the employment-related daycare program, down from about a high of 12,500 in December of 2000 into about 10,000 cases today. So as the TANF caseload inches up a little bit, typically employment-related daycare inches down a little bit. Currently, employment-related daycare is available both to folks who are leaving the TANF program and becoming employed and folks who are otherwise low income but are employed. In the governor's budget, the proposal is that the TANF program would be restricted to those folks who are leaving TANF. That is to say, those are the folks who would be eligible. Folks who hadn't been on TANF would not be eligible. This wouldn't mean folks that were on it currently would have to leave the program. They would be grandfathered in. Any other questions about employment-related daycare? In the food stamp program, then, we've talked some about this. Major changes in that really began in 1996 with federal welfare reform. They also had a number of food stamp provisions. Many non-citizens were disqualified from the food stamp program, and able-bodied adults between 18 and 50, federal terminology, the ABOD population, had to meet work requirements. Now, those work requirements were often waived for states that had high unemployment rates, and Oregon was one of those. But in any event, the food stamp caseload across the country declined significantly, and at least in partial response to that, we began some outreach to help folks who needed food stamps get them. And on top of page 10 is a listing of the outreach activities and the activities that we undertook to help folks get food stamps are listed there.
Okay. You know what? I've asked this question of LFO a bunch of times, and I just want to bring it up publicly, that I find it extremely difficult to go through a phase two evaluation of your various programs without the financial data. And I keep getting told it's because DHS is so large. But DHS is not a huge monolithic organization. It's got multiple components. And I'm wondering if, Ramona, is there a way that this committee could get the financial data showing the expenditures, the FTEs, the allocation of funds, the revenue sources and everything, so that instead of going over paragraphs of data, I mean, this is just information and it's very valuable, but it's like an extension of phase one. How do we evaluate the finances without the financial data?
Chair Richardson, I'm getting some nods that yes, we can provide that. I think the way this tool here is done, we felt we were complying with what the instructions were on how to do the tool, but we certainly have the information available by program and by FTE and by expenditure. Is that not correct, Vic?
Okay, then I turn. Why
Mr. Chair, what we do not have is the audited governor's recommended budget orbits numbers for the agency. And the reason we do not have that is because as the adjustments to the governor's budget have to get into to the system, because DHS is such a large agency and it's one agency within the system, not piecemeal, all of that information has to, all of those adjustments need to get submitted into the system, and because of the extensive adjustments in the governor's budget, that's a lot of work. That being said, generally the budget management division, when they're going through agency audits, we'll do smaller, less complex agencies first to get more of them through the process so that those budgets are available. So basically it's a case of prioritize those to get as many done as possible as quickly. And usually DHS is, if not the last, one of the last agencies through that orbits process. But we do have detail available on the individual program things, as Ramona has said. We just don't have the audited orbits budget system numbers.
Well, it's like you said, do you have any other questions on employment-related daycare? I have 50 questions, but this is not the place to tie them in. I would like to know how much it costs, how many people are involved in it, what are the various rates, what is the time that's involved with this? Is it permanent? You know, that a person can be making $8 an hour, have three kids, have the government be paying for the child care for that person indefinitely, and then you take all the other benefits and they end up, it's a negative situation. I mean, it costs more for them to work than what they're earning. There's many, many things that are involved in it, and I don't have any data to do that with, and so we're in a phase two, which we're supposed to be able to bore down, and it would just be extremely valuable to actually have financial data to look at. Do you feel the same way with that?
Yep.
And do you feel the same way? I would propose that we not waste any more of your valuable time, because you're going over things at, we were at a $50,000 or 50,000 foot level in phase one. We're now at a 42,000 foot level, and we need to actually be going over the detailed figures so that we can move into a phase three, because the co-chairs are going to be asking for recommendations on do we fund, do we not fund, do we support the governor's recommended budget or not support that. And so if there's no objection, I would like to adjourn this meeting and have provided to us the financial records so that we can go over them, and then we'll reschedule this so that we can actually have meaningful questions to ask rather than just staying over, you know, just kind of going at this level. Would that be all right?
Chair Richardson, we appreciate that. And just, I guess, for the record, I just feel I need to say that what we have tried to follow were the instructions that we actually had. I guess Director Weeks is going to speak to that point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. And we can provide you with what you ask. I understand the reason for you wanting to see those numbers. We're happy to do that. We'll work on it as quickly as possible. What you have is what we were instructed to give you. And we've tried to do that to the letter. And we will now do what you've asked for us to do now, because we can do that regardless of where Orbitz is. We can give you data about each of these programs, who served, what the cost is per person, what the total cost is, how long they can be on it. Of course we can do that. That's not what we were asked to do, with all due respect.
In all of the other budgets that we're going through, we've got that kind of information where we can actually compare some things and see what the trends are and see what the expenditures are so that we can, you know, be responsive to the needs of the people in evaluating a financial budget. And the hugeness of DHS makes it difficult, but we're going at it in cluster form. And if you weren't asked to do that, I'm not sure why it was, you know, it was so different. But it would be very helpful if we had more data that we could use so that we could make any kind of meaningful use of the time that's being spent, because we don't. And maybe that's not how it's been in the past. I don't know. But
well,
so
Mr. Chairman,
we want to really do a good job.
This whole exercise is different. So we're all learning, Mr. Chairman. This is not how it was done in the past. It was very different. And as Sheila pointed out, the department has never been among the first. You know, so there was always more time, and you reviewed this budget at the end after there was more experience on the part of the members and more information available and so on. So we're all learning in a very different process that has been created, and we will provide you with what you've asked for, and you'll need to. I don't want to have a situation where it's like bring me another rock. Let's be really clear about what you'd like. I think we understand, and we will get it to you, and get it to you just as quickly as we can.
The basic question is, what do each of these programs cost?
Okay,
you know, it's kind of like the questions we're asking about the collections. You know, it's high level to say, you know, we're bringing in this amount of money, but is that good or is that bad? You know, if we're looking at, you know, the raw numbers that Representative Hanna was coming up with, that it costs more money to run the program than we're bringing in, then that's not a very effective collection agency. And so the reason we didn't go any further with that is because we don't have the numbers to do that. And so we need to actually see the numbers before we draw any kind of conclusion on that. But it applies to the other programs as well. And so I would just like to have, you know, program by program, what the figures are.
And Mr. Chairman, much of that is in the governor's recommended budget. You can go in the governor's recommended budget right now and find out what the costs are and what the number of recipients are. And so we will go in and we will pull that out for you.
Well, I can do that. And I looked at that in December, but I'm a different person now. Then,
yes, sir.
What was I looking at? I didn't. It was just.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we can simplify it by pulling it out of the budget itself and give it to you in a more direct way.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, I had to step out for a few minutes there. Just a question directed at LFO. This is really a great deal. This is the purview of LFO, and you do that analysis for us. We realize we're up here for 6 months at the most, and that we spend a great deal of that time doing things other than this, and we count on LFO to vet these numbers so that the high level we get is backed up by stuff that really makes sense. But the chair wants to look behind those numbers and make sure that that is really what's going on. I sense his frustration. I have a great deal of it myself sometimes in these programs. I'm especially concerned, as we talked about yesterday, that some of the things we want to do in the interim, where we do have time to look at this and have time for a longer conversation, it's really difficult to do because of the way we we've set our state legislature up. Having said that, I still think that getting those numbers out and giving us all a sense of whether or not the numbers are real, which I think probably we're going to find they are for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong, and if I am, I'll be the first to admit it, or somebody will do it for me. Is worthwhile doing, and I would suggest that what you've done is to say, let's stop right now, get those numbers, take a look at it. Maybe something would be more worthwhile than sitting here, sort of going back and forth about what we need in our hands. So if everyone's agreeable, I would certainly support that. But I want LFO to be intimately involved in that, and sure, that means you, okay, to help us through those numbers and in ways that make sense for us.
Mr. Chair, what I would suggest maybe as a starting point is to take the program priority list that was provided that has the budget numbers for each of the program expenditures, have the agency match the support staff pieces, which as you remember weren't ranked in priority order, but match the support staff pieces to the programs as best they can, recognizing that some of those staff serve multiple programs. But maybe that will get you a better sense of the cost for each of the programs, and I think that's something that the agency could try to do. And then match that up with a brief summary of the basics of the program, who, what, where, why, and how. You know, what's the basic direction of the program, how many people does it serve, cost per client, or however they want. However, it makes sense to represent that for each individual program.
Oh, can we get the orbits for your cluster?
Mr. Chair, the agency as a whole goes through orbits as a whole. It does not go through by cluster. So the answer to that is no, you can't get the audited orbits by cluster. The budget detail, I believe, is available. It's not the audited numbers is the only caveat, but you know 99% of the numbers would be there.
Yeah, that's. I'm not an auditor. I'm not an accountant, but I you know as long as it's close and it gives me comparisons, you know one thing that helps with for me is to see what the trends are. I can then focus on things that I need, you know things that are out of line.
Mm-hmm.
I can ask about, but I have to know. Any of this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, does Sheila's suggestion sound like what you're looking for? Again, we don't want to spend a lot of time doing something that it's not on the track that you want. Does her suggestion sound correct to you?
Unless it's labor intensive, because this, if you're running a business, so you must have data information that you could just do a run for us. You know, I mean, you have.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like profit loss kinds of statements. You know, I'd like to have. A balance sheet kind of statement. I'd like to see those kinds of things, but in I know that it's a little different here, and so we have orbits, and it gives me headings of revenue and expenditures, and I can see those, and then I see where the designations of employees. I notice in every budget I've looked at so far, I've asked before what the relationship is between management and staff. And the highest I've seen so far is 1-6. And one of the budgets I've looked at was 1-2, that you have one manager for every two employees. Well, you know, I want to see what the structure is and how the finances are. And you know, and I understand you've got 9,500 employees, and I would die before I could get through all that. But it just means they have to back off some. But nevertheless, as we look at programs, some are more important or some seem to be more volatile than others. And so even spot audits are good. And I'm not an auditor, but I can say, okay, I'm going to look closely at this one and just see where things are at. But as I'm reading through the data that I've gotten so far, it's too high level. So to answer your question, I think so. Maybe you say it again. Because some of this is...
Mr. Chair, what I was suggesting that on the program priority list, for example, the TANF piece, the jobs piece, employment-related daycare piece, all of those were separated out in individual budget line items.
Right.
The part that was missing that I think you want to get to is the total cost of the program, which would be the staffing piece associated with that. And so what the department would need to do would be to go back into the staffing piece, which they had on the list but hadn't divvied up by program, but try to make some allocation as best they can of that by program so you can look at a total program cost, if you will, and then match that with a summary program description. What's the basic program? How many people does it serve? You know, average daily population or whatever is appropriate for looking at that particular program.
Well, that's the next step, because it does tell us the administration and the costs that weren't part of the prioritization sheet information. But I'm really looking for financials.
Financials.
I want to see what the not the this program costs $482 million. I'd like to see what the component is of it. And maybe it's, I don't even know how much. Well, I think employment-related daycare seems like it was either $7 million or $13 million was your part that comes from the Department of Employment, whoever is handling that, and that. But that was a different budget that I looked at. And so if I'm looking at employment-related daycare, you receive X amount of dollars. The source is from what sources? How is it spent? And what does it cost to make those expenses? What percentage of it is going to direct payments? And what amount of it is going to overhead to make the direct payments? That's what I'm trying to come up with.
Well,
can you help me get that kind of information?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, as I said before, everything you've described is in the agency's budget request. Now, we'll pull it out for you.
Agency's budget request to the governor, not in the GRB itself.
Our request to the governor. We have to lay out by program what the costs are, what the revenue sources are that support the cost, which is what you just asked for,
okay.
How many people are going to work in that. Now, and we can pull that stuff together for you.
We're exactly in harmony on that. I know you've got the information, and it's been provided.
We had to use,
I just don't...
Yeah, we had to have that to build the budget.
Okay, so I would like to see the data, assuming it's still current. I mean, you probably provided that almost 10 months ago. To start building the governor's budget, but maybe it's on your database and you just do an update as of such and such a date. In my own business, I would say I want this information as of this date, and the computer would give it to me. I don't know if you have the capacity.
At a lower level.
We don't have, Mr. Chairman, we don't have the same capacity you may have in your own business.
Size and scale.
There's some scale issues and stuff. So, but we will. I think we have a grasp of what you want. We'll work directly with Sheila to test, keep testing that we're getting the right material. And
okay, thank you very much.
And deliver it as quickly as possible. So, I mean, are you, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, are you wanting to start on this again tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow's Friday.
You're not scheduled generally, but I just want to.
Well, we haven't done public notice. Plus, as it turns out, it's an education day, and so some of us are booked to be in multiple schools tomorrow, so we wouldn't be able to do that. We have public hearings set for Monday and Tuesday. We need to work it out with your schedule as well as ours.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to reschedule an additional meeting. And well, actually, yeah, we probably should do it. It needs to be a public meeting because this has been a public discussion. I mean, you know, we want these kinds of questions to come out. We can do our research in private and then have one more meeting where we can come up and say, okay, here's areas that we'd like to focus on, give you a heads up on it, and then the public can all participate in any benefit that this exercise has been for us to actually go through these figures. And hopefully, I mean, it'll just be to clarify things. But we'll be more useful as a subcommittee if we have that kind of information.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, we would otherwise plan to start on health services, I believe, on Wednesday. SPD, Seniors and People with Disabilities, on Wednesday. Is this information that you will be wanting for each of the other clusters as well?
Yes. Yeah, we're going to have the same conversation on it. Could we set Wednesday over, and then we have Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday for CAF, and then we can still do public testimony if you like on Monday, Tuesday, and then have this other on Wednesday, and that allows us to have some time to put things together or tell us where it's at, and us time to read it at night. because you have a lot of programs. Would that be okay?
Mr. Chair, we can reschedule senior and people with disabilities to start on Thursday and come back to this on next Wednesday.
Okay, and if the people with senior people with disabilities could also provide that information, then we will try and read that also by Wednesday night so that we would be more responsive for the Thursday meeting with SPD. Is that okay?
I have a question, though, since this is the first time I've been on Ways and Means. Ms. Baker, do Ways and Means usually get into the detail? Have they in the past gotten into the detail that we are requesting at this point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I would say it varies depending on the members of the committee and what they want to get into. Generally, there is some high-level numerical detail available, as we have now, in terms of individual expenditures and that kind of thing. Again, it varies. Sometimes, I would say not usually. The presentations that we make and that the agencies are asked to make are sort of a mix of high-level budget detail and then focusing in on the budgetary changes. And as Senator Bates said, our office does go into much more detail at the lower-level numbers than usually the subcommittee members would do. But, again, it varies depending on the members and their interests.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Yeah. This has been a different process this session than it has the past, and it may be that I'm just learning a new process of setting priorities. My personal preference would have been that we started with these kind of discussions in January and had gone directly to phase two, but the co-chair wanted to set priorities and get an overview of the agencies first. And I will continue to support him in that role, although I have some concerns about it. Not so much that's a bad thing to do, because it is an important thing to do, but we haven't got time up here to do that and do phase two also. And so I felt phase two, what we're calling phase two now, has been pushed back a great deal. I also felt that we operate more as a board of directors in these situations, set broad policy, depend on LFO to do the detailed work for us and vet those numbers that come to us so that we know they're real. In the last couple of sessions, there's been some questions about caseload numbers, some other things that are very concerning. So I share that concern with the members of the subcommittee. I also feel that as looking at it from a board member point of view, that we are in a position that we should order specific audits in certain areas by organizations we trust to give us that information. I think that's where you would like to go. And essentially, it gives you some sense of security if you audit carefully and look very deeply into one particular part of a budget and find the information you've gotten there at a higher level was backed up by real numbers. I think that's what you're asking for. I think that will be useful. Having said all that, I would still like to see the subcommittee work at a point of looking at it from the level of a board member, set broad policy. We have to get a reshoot here in the next week or two. That reshoot is going to be a compilation of our expected costs for the next year and a half, and we're going to have to work with those numbers very carefully and make very big policy decisions about how we make that work into an overall budget. And that's going to be a very difficult and time-consuming task. I think we need to save our energy and time for that, so that if we can get this part done that you just outlined prior to the reshoot, I think we'll have done good work. But we've got to be ready for that reshoot and be ready to deal with that reshoot, because I think we're going to get some information that we may not like too well. Mm-hmm. This will make our job even tougher.
That's true.
In addition, I would like to see us make recommendations on the interim that if we really want to audit a certain area, if we want to do a different kind of staffing report, sorry, Gary here, throw anything at me, if we want to do a different kind of staffing report, then we make that recommendation and we make it happen. Because long term, I think some of the stuff that happens in the period of time between sessions is the most important work we do. That gives us time to be thoughtful and careful, look deeply into budgets, get the information we really need, and in a collaborative way, hopefully, make changes that make these programs more efficient, more effective. And I think that's where we need to go long term. So I would be fully supportive of what you're talking about short term. But I'm gonna say that for the time we have left here, which is limited now, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The time we have left is limited here. We've got to get ready for that reshoot, and that's going to be what's going to be all of our efforts to make that reshoot work for us inside the larger budget.
Well, I'm spending my evenings on the rebalance, and we haven't even got to the reshoot yet.
The reshoot's coming, and that's going to be the most important thing we do in this committee, I think.
I know that there's a lot of constituents that tune into this, and on the internet, we've done these Ways and Means go out and about meetings, and several people have come up and said that they watch this committee on the internet or when it's on, or they listen to it. And so what we're talking about is a rebalance, is to determine what adjustments need to be made to get to finish the current biennium. The last quarter is still, there's some issues on finances. The reshoot is to look at adjusted numbers that might change what was in the governor's recommended budget as we look for the next biennium, the 05-07 budget. And so we want to make sure that that we still have accurate bed count projections of utilization of different programs, those kinds of things, because it all affects how much money is needed to be budgeted. And as the preliminary indications are that we may be a little short on money when comparing current figures with those that were obtained and used in the budget, or the recommended budget that came out last December. And so these are complicated things, and so we're dealing with the data that we're going through, plus trying to make sure there's enough money to finish the current biennium, plus make sure that the data that we're looking at, which has been printed and based on previous data, is correct, and so that the reshoot will give us some adjustments that need to be made. So it's a little complicated.
It's very complicated, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that. We're going to have information to compare with from December to 3 or 4 months later with completion of the last biennium, and we're going to try to predict some very difficult things for the next 2 years, and we'll have to adjust those things as we go along through those 2 years as best we can inside a shell that is set for the most part, and that's going to be really tough. And the numbers you're trying to give us are going to be extremely important. I think you all know that, and we know we've had difficulty predicting caseload and some other things in the past. So it's something we have to look at carefully.
Okay, thank you for all the clarification. I think that there's probably political consequences of canceling or adjourning this meeting right now. And
Mr. Chair, I don't think there are any.
No,
you don't. You think that is?
No, I think that
because I don't want to make anybody look bad or offend anybody or anything like that.
No political consequences for us, Mr. Chairman. So.
And I don't think for anybody else. I think it's wise to, if we feel we can use our time more effectively outside of committee, then come back in so that members can look carefully at this one part of the budget and then move on. It's important to do that. We obviously can't drill down every single budget all the way through DHS this way, but this happens to be the first one up, and it might be helpful for everybody to see that effect. And then move on and get ready for the bigger picture.
All right. Well, if everybody's in agreement, then we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting and look forward to this additional information. Thank you so much for everyone and for your comments and for the extra assistance you're going to give us. And with
Thank
that,
you.
We'll adjourn.